have 1 week of the retreat, winter's retreat, right almost to the spring equinox. So contemplate the, you know, this sense of something coming to an end. That's to, you know, contemplation is to not to analyze or think about it, but just to notice the difference with the way things begin and end. Something that begins and you still don't know what. It's in the future, and now most of the winter's retreat is the past, in the sense of it finishing or ending is like this. And you're just noting. So the beginning of something, the birth, is always this. The unknown, you know, you can look forward, you can dread the beginning of a winter's retreat, you know, you can look forward to it, anticipate, or you might dread it, having 3 month silent retreat, because it's unknown what, you know, what will happen and be silent and all this, and one can dread about what possibilities of misery or possibilities of insight and bliss is unknown. The future is the unknown. And then the past is, we remember what's happened, much of what has happened, or some of what has happened over since the retreat began. So the past is memory. What we remember in the future is what we don't know. And now is the knowing. So he's establishing this sense of now. Pachubana Dhamma in the Pali word, the here and now Dhamma. Now in the pure presence is ever transcending, reiterated over and over again, pointing always to the wake up now. Enlightenment is now. Unconditioned, nibbana, non-self, desirelessness, purity is now. What can we actually, how can we relate to the now is to awaken to it, isn't it? Because it's not a memory, now is not a memory. And it's something that we can know directly, so it's not the future, what we don't know. Now is the knowing. This is the way it is. It's like this. In the and this, of course, is something to keep reminding yourself, like all the meditation techniques or the devotional practices or whatever, religious forms, icons, symbols, chanting, and all the rest isn't meant to be some kind of superstitious. Thing that we hold to, but to keep reminding us, awaken now. In and even though we can understand this and appreciate it, it's an imminent act in the present. It's very simple, and it's not like when we talk about right effort. It's not too much effort, like wanting to be here and now, holding to the idea of awakeness and being awake now. We can go over the top, you know, just try too hard. So, I've got to pay attention, I've got to be mindful, I've got to really, you know, look at my body and breath and listen to the sound of silence and the other. And that's like grasping the idea, isn't it? And then really putting forth enormous effort. And all you do is end up just being totally frustrated, because it's you get a headache, or you just drive yourself into despair. You're just trying too hard. Or the other thing, just the idea that you shouldn't use any effort. There's some various teachings that you shouldn't use effort, so you don't use any effort. Then you just fall asleep, or your mind just wanders all the time. So those are the two extremes, isn't it? Like too much effort and not enough effort, and right effort, some wayamo, isn't it? Where you're beginning to sense a balance. And that's why it's awakened awareness, isn't it? I've got to pay attention and be awake, and kind of an imperative that you're using to kind of make yourself do something. But to be awake and aware is a very simple act. Listening, learning to relax and to trust. And these, it takes time and a continuous kind of willingness to fail and start anew. And it, over the years, as you keep practicing, and that's why I keep saying trusting yourself, trusting your ability to know what you are experiencing. Not a matter of you can't know what's really happening or what's going on. You've got to depend on a teacher or somebody. Something else. Or the danger of always conceiving yourself in terms of being a personality that is a certain type, certain problems, certain shortcomings and faults and things that we've got to do in order to become. And that's the way the world is, and we do it to each other. We think, he's like this, she's like that. He's got a problem with anger, she's got a problem with low self-esteem, and all and all like that. And we can kind of hold these things in as if they were, a kind of permanent personality about each other, about oneself. But an awakened state here and now, and that awakens. There's no person, and you can be aware of what the kind of assumptions you have about who you are and what you're like. So I'd like to. With Buddha's teaching, the idea of starting at ground zero, There's no, like the they call it the in Zen, the man of no fixed position. There's nothing to grasp. There's no doctrine to grasp. You're not operating from some kind of thesis or premise or doctrinal position. It gives you nothing, and Buddhism really doesn't give you anything to grasp. And then, of course, we find that that's rather frightening, because we would like to be told, well, should I believe this, or is this right? And, you know, we'd like to have something to grasp, because then we know how to grasp, and we feel, you know, some sense of relief at being able to grasp things. But to not be anybody and have nothing to do and be enlightened in the present emotionally is just, that's very threatening. You just want to scream. Because emotionally we're conditioned to be a person and to believe in all the things that we grasp, believe the ignorant views and positions of the society we're in. And it gives us a sense of security to believe in things that everybody else believes in, because then you kind of support each other's ignorance. But to start from ground zero, from here and now, at this point, the Axis Mundi, the still point, the Bodhi tree, the place of enlightenment, that's the conundrum, isn't it, of this life. And so it's like you're suspended. You don't, what? I don't know. But in that, what, I don't know, that sense of not knowing is a, stops the thinking mind, and but there's an awareness. It's like you're learning to pay attention, to be awake, just to even if only lasts for 2 seconds. Listening, the sotawanta. It's that poised state of being. It's not like deep samadhi and going into the jhanas. It's the point of just awakened awareness in the present. And so it's overlooked. You know, most of our lives we don't, even though we experience that, we're not conscious of it. We don't value it, because the programming of the mind, the emotional habits and the culture that we live in is very much based on becoming, on attainment, on getting, changing, acquiring, getting rid of things. So it's ongoing kind of trying to, you know, we easily use meditation as some kind of something we've got to get. I'm just a beginner and I've got to get and be better at it and you know, get rid of my defilements. But in that simple act of sotawanta, of listening, it's like pure presence is ever transcending. There's an awareness, isn't there, of that very assumption that I'm somebody who's got to do something in order to become something better in the future. If you trust in this practice, it's like you learn. It's like you're suspended almost. Just kind of suspended in thin air, just hovering. This is just my way of expressing it. And you learn to trust in that state. Because there's nothing else to trust in. Everything else is takes you into the, you start remembering the past or planning for the future. So you know, just, the mind will always find something. Well, in holy life, isn't it, sometimes you find yourself obsessed with just trivial little things. Even after years of profound, intensive practice, suddenly your mind just gets obsessed with whether somebody likes you or not. It's like a void, isn't it? It wants to be filled. Anything will do. You kind of wish you could fill it with kind of profound and interesting, worthwhile subject. But sometimes this in that state of whatever goes in there sometimes can be quite, you know, in terms of our value systems, trivial or ridiculous, not worthy, kind of. So don't let that bother you if your mind gets petty and all that. Just learn to trust in just, that's okay, you know, it's not a matter of judging it, but of just not making a problem about it and then awakening again. Into the silence, in that state of pure attention. So, ye soda one ta ba mun chan tu satang. It's an act of faith, a sadha, of just relaxing into the present. Sounds easy, but it's not something where we're conscious of. Now, I mean, probably when you've had mystical experiences before or had some kind of blissful experiences, you actually... That's what's happened. You just let go of yourself and all that, and just kind of relaxed into pure being. But that was, if you know, usually it's more by accident, not, and so you think, oh, that's really great, and then you want to have it again. But in meditation, and so I have to let go of the memory of it, you know, not trying to conceive it or remember previous experiences, but learning to relax into the present, just letting go, just willing to be and with the way it is, you know, with the tensions of the body, with the state of mind you're in. It's not a matter of, you know, just trying to get rid of it, but of just accepting even the unpleasant, unwanted conditions that you're experiencing. This desire to get rid of things is very strong. You're just wanting to get rid of pain or bad thoughts or emotional hang-ups. So, in this, because this is such a strong desire, then I found it helpful to embrace and welcome. And so I would even say that you can stay forever if you want. You know, or please don't go away. And becoming quite simple-minded, in fact, like willing to not become quite like almost like a moron or something. Not rather than trying to become a wise, a sage of some sort, an authority on meditation, and you can get interviewed by. What is enlightenment? Or tricycle? Or Buddhist society? In contemplating our life as alms mendicants, as samanas, recognize that where sometimes we get confused is we don't clarify what we're doing. We tend to maybe come from some kind of vague ideas or inspiration. Or we can think that we have to do this. We have to. This is the only way you can do it is by becoming a monk or a nun, and we have to do it this way. So that these are, even to be able to see these kind of ideas we have is not that they're wrong even, but attachment to those ideas. Always create it will bring suffering. Like monastic life, if we're doing it just because we feel we have to or we should, and grasping that, then it does become dreary, just like anything else does. Marriage or any profession or anything becomes boring and dreary when it becomes merely an act of compulsion and assumptions and duties. Monasticism, is because it is a kind of high-minded way to live, isn't it? Quite refined in its own way. I mean, when living in monasteries over 30 years, and you forget sometimes, at least I do, what the rest of the population of this planet is having to put up with. Right. We do live on a quite a refined level of experience. Then we do become very sensitive to it because the life itself is learning to let go of all the defenses and all the kind of a way we protect ourselves from the world. In the world, you got to find ways of kind of protecting yourself from survival of the fittest. Learn how to survive in the jungle because it's not it's very competitive life usually, and you got to find a way to make a living, and you've got to just get out there and kind of do the best you can, and. In a society that doesn't even adhere to any kind of agreed moral standard anymore. and that it's not. I remember when I was a boy growing up, this 60 years ago, the idea, I mean, even, you know, even the, there were certain things that even the worst boys never did, like never beat up old women. That was just unheard of. Or, you know, to go and beat up or rape an old woman with, or snatch her purse or something like that. I never heard of any of that happening when I was a boy. And the idea of anyone that would do anything like that, even among the most delinquent, there was even a kind of nobility even among criminals and delinquents. You know, there are certain things one would just never stoop to do. It'd be so low. And now you hear that it's quite common. You hear old ladies in London living alone are going to live in terror that they're going to be raped by young boys or going to be, you know, beaten up, murdered. But I'm from a previous age, like the dinosaurs, where there was 70 million years ago. This was in the United States, you know. It wasn't England either. There was a sense of honor. Like when you fought, you never kind of hit below the belt, and these kind of things that, you know, the ideals of manhood, and kind of gentleman, being a gentleman that we adhered to even as children. And now that's all, that doesn't seem to have much. It seems like below the belt's fine, you know, just win, you know, get in there first and win. And there's not common agreement on moral issues anymore. It's like to kill, and even, you know, like capital punishment, or even the idea of trying to go into Iraq and kill Saddam Hussein is, to a lot of people, seems like a good idea, you know, just get him out of the way. Send the CIA in, some kind of secret plot. All these intelligence organizations, just knock him off and be, you know, expedient. But in terms of morality, that doesn't work. Just in Banadibata, it's not. So even on the, you know, you can kind of condemn the Serbs for going into Kosovo and chopping up a few Albanians. But also, you know, Americans were quite willing to jump onto Baghdad and with all their weaponry and which would involve the slaughter of a lot of quite innocent people, because of there's morality. It's power, isn't it? It's more a question of power, not of moral agreement. So the world is like that at this time. It's not a world that knows what it's doing. It has no common goal for itself. It's more or less trying to develop an affluent society is about probably the common denominator, what most people would want. But that's degradation, isn't it, of our humanity, just to use our lives just for developing some kind of material affluence. Meaningless. There's no, you know, when you do have it, it's You know, you still, your life is, has no purpose, no meaning. It's just, you know, you have wasted your life on nothing worthwhile. So what we're doing here, recognize that it is something that is rare, not something that when you live here all the time you think it's quite ordinary. Then when you go outside you realize how rare it is, the kind of commitment and the refinement of the life, the high moral standard, the agreed moral standard, and then the way of relating to each other in terms of developing good manners and respect and trying to help each other and cooperate. But in spite of all that, it's still difficult, isn't it? And even though when you have a community like this, it's still difficult. Because emotionally, we still get carried away. We still get lost. We still forget. We still have desires of, instinctual desires and emotional needs and habits that hang around and that are that still influence our behavior in the present. So that's why it's not a matter of trying to get rid of it and try to deny it or even change it, but understand it. And so understanding isn't analyzing, but willing to put it in the context of what it really is. It's like this. Your understanding dukkha or suffering, the First Noble Truth, is the willingness to really admit suffering is like this. Right now it's like this. That's understanding it. It's an intuitive acceptance of what you're experiencing. It's not a criticism or not trying to blame it on anything or analyze why do I have to feel like this. But feeling like this is like this. And so then your mind is open and receptive to what you are feeling, physically, emotionally. And as you trust in your ability to understand and accept what you're feeling in the present, then you're also it becomes aware of that it's changing. It's anicca. The three characteristics then we use, anicca, dukkha, anatta, as a way of contemplating experience in the present. When the retreat finishes, just keep. I found very much still like developing the awareness around the sound of silence helpful. So that going into keeping busy, having things to do, I still use that. And developing it in situations that it's very difficult with noise. Or in the middle of a meeting, or in the kitchen, or in some place, you know, that you get easily lost or caught up. So I also develop a kind of really enormous respect for the sound of silence. So when I wake up in the morning, are you there? Yeah, there it is. You're there. You're always there. You're still there. Good morning. There's a way, just my upaya, what it means, not just seeing it as a noise in the ear that you've got to pay attention to, but using it as a, you know, developing a kind of love for it and respect. So then you have to go to a meeting, a work meeting, and you know there's going to be some acrimony. Somebody's going to, you know, got something on their mind, an axe to grind, and you dread going to this meeting. And so you feel this dread, but then, are you still there? And you say, oh, well, at least, you know, you'll be with me. So then you know, during the meeting, you're not just caught in just grin and bear it and put up with it, and the totally negative kind of reaction. But it can also develop this sense of this silence and trust and relief. You know, it doesn't really matter if people lose their tempers and say terrible things or what happens, it doesn't really matter, this worldly, this, because you've always got this silence with you. You've got a refuge. It's not, the world isn't, you don't have to have harmony and peace among all the members of the society and if they feel all right. You know, you're not going, oh please, let's not lose our tempers now, let's not say anything we shouldn't, and let's not rock the boat, and let's, you've got to be careful, because that one is really, you know, a sensitive person. They'll blow up if you say the wrong. You've got to be really careful. And you go, oh God, you know, walking on eggshells, pussy footing. Life is like that. You know, we've got to pussy foot around life. Somebody's going to get upset or offended if you raise your voice, if you're too loud, or you're too soft. What I think, if you want my opinion, so loud and noisy, American like. If you want my opinion, why don't you speak up? Not as irritating, you have to strain to hear you, you're just always talking, so it's not like you're afraid. Too soft, too loud, and there's disagreements on, you know, whether you should paint the wall purple or chartreuse. But then, are you still there? Oh, everything's all right. I mean, my way I developed it is so that it's meaningful to me. It's not, and I trust it, because as you trust it more and more, then you can then the worldly conditions aren't so important to you. You know, they're not, you know, whether you get your way or people appreciate you or whatever, it's no longer so important when you've got this refuge. But if all you've got is yourself as a person trying to make it in the world, then you know, you're really set up for suffering. Because not everybody's going to, you know, appreciate you. They're going to oftentimes try to humiliate you. You know, if you're a threatening person, if I think you're better than I am, then you know, I've got to, on the personal level, I've got to kind of make sure that you keep you in your place and things like that. The survival, you know, on the personal level, because you know, I've got to survive as a person. That's all I have is my personality. You know, I don't want to have to live in this world feeling that I'm just humiliated and looked down on. I want to be respected. I want a lot of things out of life, so that I'll feel okay. I'll feel secure and all right about myself. But if there's no person, the personal side isn't important anymore. Are you still there? It's okay. Because then it's then you can see this kind of this thing in oneself that is so frightened of life and so threatened and so unstable and insecure, because it, on that level it is. The conditioned realm is unstable and insecure. No, it's just the way it is. You know, it's not your fault. It's just the way the conditioned realm is. The anicca dukkha anatta. But if your only identity, you know, and your only refuge is being a person, a personality, being somebody, then you are set up for endless bouts of dukkha and disappointment. Because that's all you can expect. You're only operating on that level. And then you can only be the top and the best for a while, then somebody else comes and becomes the winner. Or you lose your job, or you get old and have to retire, you have a stroke, or you're made redundant, or something happens. You know, on the condition plane, you know, you can't stay at a fit peak for very long. But no matter what, you know, your teeth fall out, you go blind and deaf. You have osteoporosis in your back. Are you still there? So this sense of because that is like the sign of transcendence, and that point there, that just at that moment, pure presence. That's pure presence. So you're noticing that, you're noting that. That's pure presence. It's not just some kind of cosmic sound that buzzes, but you're noting that when you really tune in and trust, then after a while you begin to, it's sustainable. And when you can rest in it and be there, then you know you can also get a much more clear perspective on the emotional habits you have. Not judging, but just you know them, and they're like things that, clouds in the sky, things that come and go, but they're no longer making a problem about it. Or being intimidated or frustrated by it. does seem like a timeless experience, like just now, there's time that seems so unreal, you know, just how rapidly, you know, how time used to seem so real to me, like each year. I still think, what happened to 1997? It was only a second ago. You know, we're well into 98. And 88 was only 5 seconds ago. Or 10 seconds ago. But the... Years ago, 1958, somebody's mentioned 1958, I was finishing off my university degree. That doesn't seem very long ago. I went to Mexico that summer. Drove from Seattle, Washington, in an old Ford, all the way down the southwest to the west coast, Mexico, down to Mazatlan, and then to Guadalajara, Mexico City, and then up the east coast to Brownsville, Texas, and then up the southern part of Texas to El Paso. That was only a few seconds ago, wasn't it? And so this was, you know, it doesn't seem long ago, as I can remember, the memory is still quite strong. Looking in the mirror now is quite a good lesson, because you say, who's that old guy? He just came back from Mexico. And you're only 20, 22, 23 years old. So this is the sense of timelessness and the sound of silence and that kind of meditation, as you do begin to, you know, emotionally find it sometimes quite strange, because emotions are very much, you know, conditioned around time, believing in the reality of time and personality. So it is like, it is, you know, that's where it's the unknown. It's like don't know, it's unknown. That state of attentive awareness is the gate, isn't it? Sotavanta. Attention, listening. So then your mind is in a state of open. It's ground zero. It's open. There's nothing there but pure presence. So in that, as you stop resisting or just overlooking or ignoring it, then of course things begin to, you understand, enlightenment. You see things, you know directly, you know things as they really are. And you're not trying to make life conform to ideas you have anymore. Or try to operate from theories and doctrines. But it's the pure presence and pure knowing, pure wisdom, pure intelligence. That is your true nature. That is you open and trust and awaken, and then you, more and more, you know the truth, realize the Dhamma. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.